Welcome to Talking Beats with me, Daniel Lelchuk. If you like what you hear, I'd love you to give us a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify, write a review, and if you're so inclined, tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. Be sure to visit our website, talkingbeats.com, where you can find much more information about the guests, support the show in various ways, sign up for the newsletter, and be in touch directly with me. As always, the dialogue continues on social media at Talking Beats Podcast. I'm so glad you're here with me. Now, to the conversation. On today's program, art critic and writer Jed Pearl. For 20 years, he was the art critic of the New Republic, and before that, a contributing editor to Vogue. He's written for the New York Times, Book Review, Harper's, and many other publications, and his books are widely respected and include the 2-volume biography of Alexander Calder, as well as Magicians and Charlatans and New Art City. He's out with a new book now. He takes a big, broad look at the world of art. The book is called Authority and Freedom, a defense of the arts, in which Mr. Pearl tries to reaffirm the crucialness of the independence of all the arts, musical, literary, and visual, and their unique and unparalleled power to excite, disturb, and inspire us, something that, as you know, comes up often on this program. As people look to the arts to promote a particular ideology, whether radical, liberal, conservative, Jed Pearl argues that the arts have their own laws and logic which transcend the controversies of any moment. As he writes, art's relevance has everything to do with what many regard as its irrelevance. Well, how popular is this point of view today? Is he going to be doing much convincing with this book? Jed Pearl joins me now. I'm pleased to have him to discuss this and much more. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here, Daniel.
I'd like to know why you felt the need to write this book, Authority and Freedom, A Defense of the Arts. What are you defending against, and why do arts need defending?
I've been writing about the arts, mostly the visual arts, and thinking about the arts for decades. And I've found, as the years have gone by, that it didn't any longer feel like enough to just talk about what drew me to the arts and what excited me in the work of particular artists, painters, and sculptors, whether contemporary or classic. I began to feel, as time went on, that I really needed to address the whole question of the arts in their relation with the wider world of culture, with the wider world of the political world, the social world. Partly, I think I began to think along those lines because a lot of the work I've done as an art critic has been for magazines that had a broad range. I was the art critic of the New Republic for 20 years, and more recently I've been writing for the New York Review of Books. And both of these are magazines that cover politics, society, economics, and all the arts. And I sometimes got the feeling that readers had this this kind of inclination to associate my views of a particular artist or my views about the situation in the art world or the situation in the museums with the more general political views of the magazine. So, for instance, the New Republic, in the years I was writing for it, in the around the turn into the new century, was often talked about as being what people called neoliberal, a sort of liberal, but with a kind of conservative slant. And then people often would say about my writing about art, that he's kind of a bit of a conservative, So this whole question of, well, where did the arts fit into the larger social picture was something very much on my mind. And in recent years, especially in the last 3 or 4 years, as we've kind of entered this time of crisis in America, crises about economic matters, social matters, questions about sexual freedom, questions about racism. I found that the arts have come to more and more be kind of cast in this highly charged atmosphere and set in this highly charged atmosphere. And I find more and more, you open the New York Times, you open the New Yorker, and the arts are always being talked about in this frame of what's going on in politics, what's going on in race relations, what's going on with, you know, questions of gender identity. For me, this posed a real problem, a real conundrum, because I am, a citizen of this country, a citizen of the world, very much concerned about questions of economic and social justice, very much concerned about those things. But at the same time, I believe that central to the power of art and the meaning of art in our world is the fact that the arts have their own laws and logic. They have what I call a freestanding power. And I deeply believe that the reason we go to the arts, whether it's a contemporary painter or a classical composer, we go to them for experiences that can't really be fit into these modalities of liberal, radical, conservative, these kind of political, social, and economic terms, which preoccupy us so much of the time. So I wanted to write a book that argued for the freedom of art, for the freestanding value of art. And at the same time, I wanted to explain why this realm of human experience that can't be pigeonholed as left or right, that can't be pigeonholed as woke or conservative. I wanted to explain why this realm of experience, the arts, nonetheless is so incredibly important to us. So that's what started me on this journey of working on and writing this book.
Let me ask for a moment, because when you say it began, so you mentioned the past couple of years. How long do you think you've been feeling these currents? You said when you were at the New Republic, there was this neoliberal description of it, and then you were lumped in with that. How much is this sort of bubbling to the surface now versus just the natural point of a progression that you saw coming 10, 20, 30 years ago? I was talking with a friend. I'm an avid cyclist. We were on a long bike ride a few weeks ago, 100 miles, and we were just chatting, and he said, well, you know, you don't understand how old the term politically correct is. You know, we think of it as something, I thought of it as something fairly new. He said, 30, 40 years ago it was being used. So is this all old stuff that is coming to the fore now, or was it greatly accelerated in the past 2 years, would you say?
That's a great question. And by the way, I'd say 100-mile bike ride. Is that what you said?
I do it regularly.
That's very impressive.
It gives me plenty of time to think about conversations like this and what question would be good and what wouldn't be. You know, when you're on the bike for 5 hours, you have a lot of time.
You're absolutely right, and your friend is absolutely right that these are very, very old questions. Since I was in college in the years around 1970, I've always been fascinated by the 1930s, which were a time of social, economic, political crisis, in some ways not unlike our own time. And I was fascinated by the extent to which in the 1930s you found people going to extremes. You had a lot of, you know, intellectuals moving leftward for a time, at least becoming, engaged with involved with the Communist Party here in Europe, and very engaged with the promise, what they saw as the hopes of the Soviet Union. And on the other side, you had conservatism in many countries moving into fascism and all kinds of autocracies. And you found in the 30s the arts at the same time being pushed in these directions, as if the feeling was in a time of emergency, art can't just concern itself with beauty or with the sort of modalities and subtleties of human experience, whether the experience of music or the visual world or words. You had this sense in the 30s that the arts had to address these flashpoint issues. And so that is very much sort of, I think, the backdrop to where we are now. I think after World War II, there was a sense in the political world, both in Western Europe and America and in parts of Asia, that people should move away from extremes. I mean, the period after World War II was this period of great liberal hope in many parts of the world. And I think at that point, there was a sense that the arts could the artists could act freely, that art could kind of find its own paths. Looking back now, it seems to me that there's almost a kind of cyclical process whereby in times of extreme crisis, social, economic, political, the arts are kind of dragged into that crisis. And yes, I think I felt that coming for a number of decades now. And I began to work on this book. It began as lectures I was giving, I don't know, maybe about 15 years ago when I began to try to think about it as well, if the arts aren't serving a political purpose or aren't directly serving racial justice or social justice, if that's not what the arts are doing, then the question for me was, why are the arts so important? I mean, why do people yearn for the sounds of music? Why do people yearn for things to look at? Why do people go to the theater to see dance, to see theater, to see plays, to see music? And that's where I began to come to this idea, which is so central to this book, that all arts are a kind of debate, a controversy, a battle, you might almost say, between authority and freedom. I think that every artist, a painter, a musician, a composer, an actor, a singer, a dancer, a novelist, a poet, every artist engages in a primary encounter between the authority of the creative traditions in which they're working, whether that's the traditions of composition, the traditions of storytelling, the idea that stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end, the traditions of painting. Paintings are generally done on a rectangle. Artists, creative people, engage with the authority of a tradition, the conventions of a tradition. And then as they master those traditions, those conventions, those systems of authority, they seek to find freedom within those, the freedom of an individual voice, an individual way of telling a story, of showing a landscape in a painting. And I think that that struggle, that debate that every artist engages in, every creative person engages in between authority and freedom, is a fundamental human struggle, because we all, whoever we are, whether you're a lawyer, a doctor, a nurse, a construction worker, whether you live in a family alone, we all live in a society, in a world that has traditions and conventions. We all deal with systems of authority, and we all seek to find some sense of freedom of individuality within that. And so I think when we turn to the arts, one of the core things we sense in the arts is this debate, this search for freedom within authority, for the sense of the individual within the group, within the society, within norms. We sense that in art. And I think it's very key to what we feel in art, what we experience in art. So, you know, if you love the art of the concerto, and you love classical music, when you listen to a concerto, you know there's this group, the orchestra, and then there's a soloist, and you know that there's a kind of dialogue that goes on between them. And when you listen to a concerto that perhaps you haven't listened to for a while or don't know before, you're curious to see how the composer has navigated that relationship between the soloist and the orchestra. And there are many different ways to do it. And in the differences in the ways that a composer does it, that composer is asserting a kind of freedom within the authority of the form. And I think as viewers, as listeners, we experience that too. So what I came to feel as I worked on this book is that the arts in a way are their own ecosystem, I would say. They have their histories, their revolutions, their conventions, their breakthroughs, and all of this goes on, I don't know if I would say at a remove from the rest of life, but it goes on in the midst of life, but it goes on in its own way. So that, you know, we can be in a time, look at the Ukrainian war. We're in a time of extraordinary crisis, and yet you can listen to a piece of music. It doesn't deny the crisis. It doesn't confirm the crisis. It does its own thing, and we need those things that art can do in the midst of society, in the midst of our world.
You write in the book, related to all this, you write, the arts, at least the greatest expressions of the arts, have often been seen as fundamentally conservative or radical or liberal in spirit, with the choice generally determined by the ideological inclinations of the person who is making the interpretation. All such efforts strike me as fundamentally mistaken. That's why attempts to identify the political or social values of Mozart or Jane Austen always fail. Popes, princes, and presidents may turn a painting or a poem to their advantage, but the struggle between authority and freedom and the artist's search for perfection or for anything else is essentially shaped by the language of art, which is a language unto itself. We often find ourselves pressed to speak about art as conservative or radical or liberal, but these are rough metaphors for an experience that has an indissoluble life of its own. That is art's ultimate value, a value that is confoundingly difficult to think or speak about precisely because there is no analogy. Art is simply what it is.
Right. I really believe that that's true. There's a wonderful letter by the great novelist Flannery O'Connor that I talk a little bit about in the book. Flannery O'Connor, Southern novelist, short story writer, who was a very serious Catholic, and she was friends with a priest who sent her a novel with a Catholic theme. I don't know that we actually know what the novel was, but so he sends Flannery O'Connor this novel thing. Oh, well, she's going to like it because it's a novel and it's very Catholic in its orientation. And she wrote back to him, Flannery O'Connor wrote back to this priest, and she said, it's a terrible novel. And therefore, the fact that it had a Catholic theme didn't matter to her. And what she said, and again, this is said by somebody who takes religion very, very seriously. She said, you have to make it a work of art first. She said, then a work of art may be turned to some social, political, religious purpose, but you have to make it a work of art first. And I think that's so important to understand. I mean, you know, so often now when you open a newspaper magazine to the cultural pages, you find that what's foregrounded in articles about new work is the sort of the social, political orientation of the creator, their sexual orientation. You kind of get all of that front loading an article. It's very common now. And then, you know, you read through and you don't really have any sense of what the music is going to sound like, or what the prose in the novel this person's written sounds like. It's all about sort of where they fit in our social, you know, economic or political world. And I think to approach things that way is to rob us of the particular things that art can give us. And again, I say this as somebody who's, you know, very much engaged in broader social, political, and economic questions. But at the same time, it seems to me to have the society, the culture, the world we really want, we need to have art, and art as this kind of freestanding world, this world with its own laws and logic. You know, it's interesting. When people who live in oppressive, autocratic societies, one of the things they often talk about craving is the freedom to read lyric poetry, the freedom to listen to Mozart string quartets, the freedom they want economic freedom, they want social freedom, they want the freedom to protest the government's policies, but they also yearn for, and this is often a very central thing that people yearn for, they yearn for for abstract paintings. You know, for decades and decades in the Soviet Union, you could not see an abstract painting in a museum. Now, why is that? Abstract paintings posed no direct threat, to Soviet power. And yet, the freestanding value of art was seen as dangerous somehow. Dangerous, I think, partly because it doesn't fit in anywhere, because it has its own life.
This may seem like a too blunt of a question, but I think people at this point who are listening are going to want to know, who is squeezing art into a political box? Is it people on the left? Is it people on the right? Who is demanding that art has a political message? Even something like a Beethoven string quartet must have some message, whether it's Beethoven himself, sort of something superimposed, or the diversity of the performers, or the location it was performed. It was in a city church as opposed to a pretty concert hall downtown or whatever. Where's this coming from? Left, right?
I think it comes from from both sides. Before I wrote for the New Republic, I wrote for about a decade for the New Criterion, which was a magazine started in the 1980s by Hilton Kramer, who'd been the art critic, the chief art critic of the New York Times, and who was at that point moving rightward. And the New Criterion in the 80s was kind of one of the bellwethers of neoconservative kind of cultural thought. And Hilton began at the New Criterion, Hilton Kramer began at the New Criterion by saying that, in a way, what I'm saying, that he wanted to create a kind of a free space, an open space for the arts, because he felt at that time that the left was beginning to have a kind of political test for art. But what happened to the New Criterion increasingly in the later 80s was that he himself began to have a his own political test for art, really a test from the right. So that art that I mean, there was a whole controversy at the magazine over the dances of Mark Morris, which I mean, Mark Morris is a great choreographer. He's also somebody who has played a lot with sort of traditional gender roles, having he would have men partnering other men and so on, and at the New Criterion, somehow the freestanding value and power of the choreography got to be kind of mixed up with what they were seeing as the sexual politics of the work. So the New Criterion published critical writing about Morris, who's really one of the most musically acute choreographers of the past generation, I would say. So I think we see it happening on both ends. And again, I think this is something we saw that when you look back to the 30s, you see it happening there. And I think it comes out of a sense of crisis, a sense of social, maybe even more, some social instability, a sense of there's a lot of fluidity in society, that things are changing, and I would say people both on the left and the right who care about the arts, it's like they want to kind of hang on to the arts and almost they want to make sure the arts are on their team. I think you get into that that kind of an attitude or a mindset. And I think it's natural. It's very ancient. In the 1920s, Trotsky wrote that he argued you can't see the arts apart from the role they have in the wider world. He said you can't understand the beauty of a cathedral unless you understand the theological, the social, the economic forces that shaped that building, and he argued that artists who, he actually argued that the reason that art matters is because art is a mirror of society, and he said to the extent we want artists to be free, we want artists to be free because we want them freely to discover the truth of society. Okay. Now, I think that's in itself actually a very dangerous idea, because if artists are sort of are the conscience of society at large, then it's like we're starting to worry, well, what do the artists think politically or economically? And then you get yourself into these jams where you gather that an artist is a political progressive, or an artist is a political conservative. You think, well, does that color their art? Does that taint their art? And you get into this kind of this very tangled kind of thinking, which Daniel, I mean, I know you've thought about this and written about this. I mean, we see this thing going on in classical music now, where there's this whole argument and line of thought. Well, is classical music white? Because the great European composers were white. I mean, so is there some a racial issue in classical music? I mean,
what would you say to that if someone came up to you on the street and said that exact question to you, Jed Burrell? What would you say?
I would probably just gasp initially. So gasping down, and as I've gasped when I've read things about this, including, sadly enough, by the music critic of the New Yorker magazine. What I would say is music has a freestanding power and meaning. To listen to Beethoven's late quartets, which I've been doing a lot lately, I mean, is to engage with a man who's you know, testing the limits of a form that was very, very different when he first mastered it, you know, and who's pushing, you know, ideas about, you know, sonority and drama and into realms that they hadn't been before. And that's what you think about. And anybody with ears can respond to that. I mean, part of the horror of this kind of line of thinking, that we shouldn't listen to Beethoven, Mozart because they were white, or we should be suspicious of The Merchant of Venice because it may be anti-Semitic, which of course is something people debate endlessly. Part of the horror of that whole line of thought is that it negates our society, one of the extraordinary things which art can give to our society, which is places where people coming from radically different places, from different social and economic situations, from different political attitudes, the arts are a place where people actually can meet, in fact, and experience together, and share and debate experiences in a whole other world, a world that isn't politics, that isn't social controversy. One of the great dreams, one of the great liberal dreams that goes back to the beginning of literacy, the spread of literacy in the 19th century, was the idea that as education opens up to more and more people, more and more people can have access to this world we're talking about, this world of the arts, or can have more and more access to more and more parts of it. I mean, look, part of the fascination of cathedrals was that this was a place where anybody could go, the poor as well as the rich, and experience the extraordinary, you know, chromatic miracle of stained glass windows and so forth. But part of the dream of 19th century liberalism, and this grew this dream all through the 20th century, was that more and more people will have access to these extraordinary things, to music, to poetry, to painting. So political correctness, as applied to the arts, seems to me to kind of chop away possibilities. I mean, I don't want, black and brown people to be not denied Beethoven and Mozart, just as I don't want to be denied Aretha Franklin and Miles Davis. You know, as a white Jewish guy, I don't want to be denied those things. So in some crazy way, the more you politicize the arts, the more you sort of rob our society of the possibilities of the arts, if you get my meaning.
It's absolutely criminal to me, because you strip away the most miraculous thing of all. I've written about this before, where I've experienced and seen people who hear music for the very first time and have no background in it. They have no knowledge whatsoever, no background. And then they sort of break down in tears, you know, at this visceral reaction, which is exactly what they should do if they feel that
way. Right.
And then, so for me to sort of see that and then decide to give them a lecture on what's happening or on, well, you know, maybe since you're Filipino, you really shouldn't be very moved by Wagner because there's no relevance to you. It seems that the most cynical and idiotic robbery of the power of art that I can think of, but that's what is happening now.
I mean, it's not, you know, I'm not saying that that we don't care about or it's unimportant who the characters are in the story, who wrote the music, whether the music picks up on traditional Filipino or Hungarian or Ukrainian folk melodies. I mean, I'm not saying that we're not interested in stories about people who live in different places or people who have different, sexual desires or interests than we have. I'm not saying that those things don't matter. But again, to go back to what Flannery O'Connor said, it all has to start in art with the making of works of art. Okay. I mean, and you know, the Flannery O'Connor's remark is also fascinating because anybody who's read a little bit of Flannery O'Connor knows that her short stories and novels are some of the most searingly immediate and often terrifying representations of the kind of extremes of human behavior and existence. I mean, Flannery O'Connor is not some kind of Olympian purist as a writer. She's somebody who is down there witnessing all the pain and ugliness of human experience. Okay. But nonetheless, she says, my original duty is to my art, to what I call, I talk about this in one of the chapters of the book, to her vocation. And I think the idea of vocation is an incredibly important idea in terms of understanding the arts. And you, of course, as a cellist, I mean, so understand this, that every art form, fiction writing, poetry writing, painting, has a there's a history and when you engage with that art form, you engage with a vocation, and a vocation is a kind of complex of systems and ideas and practices and that have gone on for a long time and that you engage with, that you enter into in order to be able to express yourself within that form. And I think, one of the things, in a way, I think a lot of this sort of politicized writing about the arts, a lot of it on the left, but some of it on the right as well, in a way, it gets the cart before the horse. I mean, it's like the subject, is like foregrounded, but how the subject is presented, how the subject is made, is realized, is not presented. That sort of it's almost like, you know, in our kind of digitized, automated world, it's like, oh well, how you made it, how you do it, is almost like, it's almost as if you're pressing a button, you know. Whereas what the arts are about is the making, and the more you experience the arts, the more alive you are to the making. You talk about somebody first hearing music and like that kind of emotional rush that this person got when first hearing something. And of course, if they go on to listen more and more, listen to different performers, listen to different performances, they'll, you know, their understanding of how it happens will deepen and enrich, you know, and it's like those wonderful conversations you can have about like how two singers sing a particular aria, right? And, you know, they can both be magnificent, but, you know, it's interesting. Two people will disagree about which one is the one that moves the most. And, you know, there'll be all kinds of interesting, you know, points that will be made. And that's all about the making of art and how important that is in the experiencing of art.
We've mentioned music a few times here, obviously, but, you know, everybody talks specifically on this show about the kind of music they're listening to in the moment. And obviously, so you had gone to a lot of concerts probably pre-COVID, and then during the height of it, you probably weren't going to as many. But what did you do with music? How did music compare with the other fields of art in the past 2 years, especially in terms of what it did for you? Because we can look in books and see reproductions of paintings, but it's very different than going to a museum and seeing it firsthand. We can look at photos of sculptures. We can listen to Beethoven symphonies. How did the experience for you of hearing music, what were you listening to, and then what did it sort of compare with when you say, okay, I need my ballet fix, so I'm going to go on YouTube? You know, it's a different experience, but it's not horrible, I don't think. I mean, listening to music at home alone is a pretty great thing.
Yeah, no, music is wonderful in that you can, I mean, look, nothing compares with the experience of being at a live performance where you're sort of, it's happening for you at the same moment that it's happening for the performer. I mean, my mother is a serious, amateur pianist, and I grew up with, you know, me and my brothers and sister had to be quiet night times because she and her friends were playing what was, as always, my mother's great passion, the classical, piano chamber repertoire, you know, the Beethoven Archduke is something that is sort of engraved in my mind. So, I mean, I guess a lot of that, my wife always says, oh, I'm always listening to things, chamber music, whether somehow a piano involved. Well, like with everybody, you kind of go through phases. I listen to a lot of Stravinsky, and Stravinsky's always very fascinates me because he did such incredibly different things. Yet it seems to me in everything he did, there's something about the delicacy of his orchestration, the sounds that he extracts from the orchestra that from instrumentalists that moves through all of that. But I miss terribly museums and galleries in the period when they were all closed, of course, for a while. I have to say, it's been a great joy. Last summer, the Museum of Modern Art in New York had this absolutely astonishing show of Cézanne's watercolors, an enormous show, which would have been, you know, a great treat under any circumstances. But, you know, thinking about it right now, I think the fact that it was maybe the first kind of explosively exciting visual thing that I saw in a museum, kind of once the museums were opening up, I think that was maybe part of what it made it such an enormously important experience for me. I mean, I also have to say, I find that, in different times in my life, different art forms have meant, you know, been particularly important for me. So like in the last maybe decade of George Balanchine's life, in the 70s, and I guess it goes into the 80s, 80s. My wife and I went to the New York City Ballet really like all the time when you had that extraordinary last generation of Balanchine dancers, Suzanne Farrell and Eddie Villella and Patricia McBride. And that was like a consuming experience. And then we saw a lot of other dance. And I don't go to dance so much now. Fiction
Why?
Reading.
Why?
Well, I don't know that I don't know that somehow it doesn't, I keep comparing things I see to those earlier experiences, and what I see doesn't increase my appetite, if that makes any sense. So that period of enormous excitement about classical ballet, and then seeing a lot of other stuff, Mark Morris and Paul Taylor and all, you know, Twyla Tharp and all that around that. But I don't know, it was still a time in my life. I think our appetites change. I mean, I was going to say, I've been reading an enormous amount of fiction. I've become a huge novel reader. I've always read fiction, but I don't know, for some reason the last few years, and maybe it is COVID, I've just read lots and lots of, older stuff I hadn't read and new stuff. And again, I don't quite know what it is. And then on the other hand, maybe one shouldn't say this, but I find I read less like art history than I used to read. I don't know. So I think one's appetites in the arts change over time, just as, you know, maybe, you know, you have a friendship with somebody that's particularly intense at one period in your life and then not so intense at another period. One of the magnificent things about the arts is they offer, there are so many possibilities. They go in so many directions, and of course, because they have what I believe is this kind of transparency in a way, because they don't lend themselves to cut and dried explanations, I think you can also re-enter things at another period in your life and see them differently. I mean, Henry James is a novelist who I adored when I was in my 20s, and then I didn't read him that much for a long time, but I found my way back to him, and I see all kinds of things in his novels and in his characters now that I didn't see them back then, because I think I'm bringing like another 30 or 40 years of experience, of my own experience to this experience that he offers me.
You know, I wish we had forever to talk, but we don't. So Jed Pearl, for the people listening who may be curious about what you're talking about, but they don't really have a framework to start, what's the best place for someone to go who says, well, I think I like visual art. I think I like paintings, but I don't really know anything about it. Where should someone go if they have this vague curiosity and they are unsure of where to start, but they think it's in there someplace?
You know, I think you can start almost anywhere. If you see a work, you know, in a museum or online that attracts you, find out who the artist is, look at other work by that artist. If you live near a museum, go walk through, see what catches your eye, and kind of let yourself go with it. I mean, don't necessarily, if you go to a museum to see a, you know, like there's some show that you've seen advertised on the, heard advertised on the radio or something, you go to see that. Also go and walk through the permanent collection in the museum and just, kind of let yourself, be pulled along, relax with stuff. Sometimes I'll be in a museum and you just be walking through a permanent collection, and if there are places to sit, which there really always should be in museums, you may see a couple, a guy and a girl, maybe in their late teens, sitting there talking, flirting a little bit, but also looking around, looking at what's in front of them. And I think it's very important to see the art experience as part of broader human experience, and let yourself feel your way into it in that way. You know, likes and dislikes, responses to art are very natural things. I mean, sometimes I say to people who get all kind of tight and nervous about like the idea of criticism or of making a judgment, I say, you know, having an opinion about the arts is the most natural thing in the world. In the days we all used to actually go to movie theaters, what's the first thing that happens when you come out of the movie theater with a friend or on a date or with your husband or wife or partner, whatever? What's the first thing that's said? Somebody says, "What did you think?" Right? And the other person states an opinion, and then do you disagree or disagree? I mean, I think it's important to see the arts as something one engages with what one has in oneself, and then you allow that experience to sort of expand what's in yourself and add to what you know and what you feel.
Jed Pearl, with the book "Authority and Freedom: A Defense of the Arts," any last words of inspiration for people who are regular readers of these publications who somehow maybe guilt them into not having seen a political agenda of a piece of art that they were supposed to have seen, therefore maybe appreciate the art less? It seems that the art culture pages of newspapers like the New York Times are filled with hints and insinuations that damage the broader possibility of public appreciation of art. What's your counter to that? To separate it, to see it, to enjoy it, to experience it on your own or with a friend and not think so much and feel more?
Yes. And you know, I think one good thing to do is to remember back to your own initial experiences of art. The kind of thing you were talking about, Daniel, with this person who was so struck by music. I mean, to think back to when you were in your teens or your early 20s or you first take to a concert or a museum or whatever it was, or heard a great jazz performance, and you were like, wow. I think it's very important to keep that in mind, that there's this kind of this visceral dimension to art, and that is at the core of art, and then understanding the why and how of that is very important. But I think we all want to keep in touch with that immediate pow, that thing that art does for us.
That immediate pow, the thing that art does for us. I think we all know what it is. If only we can all get back to it, we'll be a lot better off. Jed Pearl, indeed. I thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with me, Daniel Lalchuk. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and write a review if you would. That really helps. The original music for this show is by Ronald Markham. The producer is Doug Christian. For more information, visit the website of the show, talkingbeats.com. Thank you for listening. This is Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk.